gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Greetings, listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by the Dispatch and Dispatch Media. I am talking to you from World Forum, which is an off-the-record thing, but I think I can say I'm here without too much worry. It's at Sea Island, one of my favorite places. One of Zoe and Pippa's favorite places. They've been to the beach here before, but they're not with me. They're home in D.C. with Kirsten, being well tended to. So I was up too early and, got a pretty full day ahead. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to write a G file. But I figured I could get this done. I left a panel on the economy of India. I think that's okay to say, to come do this really quickly. So I don't know how long I'm going to go and I don't know what I'm going to talk about because I just had to get started. And so here we go. On Wednesday, I wrote the Wednesday G-File on a point I've made here a few times and I will make over the next 8 months many times more, that people are catastrophizing too much. Basically, I wrote, look, 5 years from now, no matter what happens in this election, you'll probably be okay. And I wrote that if we reelect Joe Biden, he will be a bad president. I don't think he's been a very good president. If we elect Donald Trump, I think we'll have bigger problems. But America will not be destroyed. Donald Trump says this all the time. Joe Biden will destroy America. Democrats will destroy America. All of his biggest superfans say it all the time, including in responses to a G-File I wrote on Wednesday. It's in ads. It's on TV. It's all over the place. Destroy, destroy, destroy. It's Flight 93 election stuff all over again. And I hate this stuff. And I don't hate it just because it's hyperbole. I hate it because if America is going to be destroyed, it's going to be destroyed because so many people think it's going to be destroyed. So that justifies them doing things that are going to destroy America to stop someone else from destroying America. And just everybody just freaking breathe into a paper bag. America is not going to be destroyed. And everyone, you know, and I'll get to the response to it in a second. But like, as I pointed out, like Donald Trump said this over and over and over again in 2020. He also said in 2016 about Hillary Clinton. But the benefit of I'm saying it in 2020 is that he then went on to lose and Joe Biden became president, the guy he said was going to destroy America. And look, I don't think that Joe Biden's been a good president. America has not been destroyed. A lot of the things that Donald Trump said were going to, you know, when he didn't say the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man, but he had some specific claims about what the form of our destruction would take. And, you know, it was like, Biden's going to defund the police. Biden's going to get rid of the suburbs. Millions of people are going to lose their jobs, blah, 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 blah. You know, and it didn't happen. I never thought it was going to happen. Similarly, I got to say, look, I honestly and sincerely think Donald Trump is an actual threat to a lot of the things I hold dear. But I still have enough faith in this country that I don't think if we elect him, he's going to be Hitler or a dictator or anything like that. He might try not to be Hitler, but, you know, to be, you know, authoritarian of some kind. And that's bad. And that should be opposed on its own terms, but not simply because of this slippery slope thing about, you know, our democracy will be over. You can read it. You cannot read it. You can subscribe. You cannot subscribe, whatever. I'm in that kind of mood these days about this stuff. But the hysteria about this stuff is far more dangerous than any of the claims that the hysterics use to justify their hysteria. If you think we're one election away from America being over, that gives you permission to act as if the rules no longer apply to you. My crowd has been saying for a very long time, and not just because Obama and Rahm Emanuel said it when Obama was president about how a crisis is a terrible thing to waste is a terrible formulation. It is in many respects, not always, it is an undemocratic or anti-democratic formulation. But this has actually been sort of a central insight on a certain sort of cross-section of conservative and libertarian academic work forever. If you've never read Crisis and Leviathan, basically all of our biggest, I shouldn't say all, I never should say all, right? I'm a multi-causal person, but a huge chunk of our most enduring public policy problems, a huge chunk of the negative consequences of the growth of the state all come from crisis, right? This is why a certain strain of sort of anarcho-libertarian crowd just basically hates war in the national security state, full stop, because they are the one of the primary engines in their reading of history. And they're not, I think they can overstate it, but they're not wrong. National security, war, are among the most important drivers of the growth of the state. And I've written about this a gazillion times, you know, the whole concept of the moral equivalent of war, which starts as a speech and an essay by William James, becomes the sort of the fundamental way of thinking about world war, about how organized the country and the economy during World War I. The New Deal was basically based on Woodrow Wilson's war socialism and war economy and the War Industries Board and all that kind of stuff. The New Dealers directly invoked, FDR asked for and campaigned, asking for permission to use the techniques that the U.S. used to fight World War I, to fight the Great Depression. You might be surprised to know, I do not think that the tool set for fighting wars and the tool set for fighting the Great Depression are the same tool sets. And then after New Deal, basically the Democratic Party becomes a cargo cult to the New Deal until present day. You know, you have Truman's Fair Deal. The Great Society was and the war on poverty, again, moral equivalent of war argument. You have Jimmy Carter talking in that fetching sweater, talking about how the energy crisis needs to be, in his words, the moral equivalent of war in terms of a crisis. Bill Clinton has his New Covenant, which is basically a ripoff of the New Deal. And Barack Obama has his New Foundation, which is a ripoff of the New Deal. You have the Green New Deal. Again, the New Deal was a moral equivalent of war project. It is this, the idea, and I should also just for name-checking purposes, there were a lot of people who were very envious of the accomplishments under the Soviets and the Bolsheviks with war communism. And I should say that, I mean, war communism ended up being a disaster, but a lot of the stuff, that sort of war mobilization stuff that the Soviets did, had bigger economic benefits than some on the right might want to concede sometimes. But that's because when you force people, including at gunpoint, to switch from donkeys to tractors, you're going to get productivity gains. It doesn't mean that just sort of authoritarian economics are always better. It just means that in some contexts, you can actually get boosts to GDP with, you know, dictatorial, coerced improvements in technology and that kind of thing. Anyway, needless to say, this idea that, you know, a war, you know, the William James argument, and William James is, you know, an underappreciated philosopher. I have my problems, my disagreements, but I think he's an honorable and brilliant guy. And his whole argument in the moral equivalent of war speech is, or essay, is that war brings out what's best in us. It causes us to put down little concerns and all work together. The only problem with war is the actual, you know, blood and gore and death stuff. So what we need to do is come up with a way to organize society as if we were at war, but without all the killing. And that idea has been central to vast swaths of progressivism ever since. I would also argue it is the living, breathing heart of a big chunk of the nationalist new right these days. Remember, there aren't a lot of new ideas. They're just changes in which teams and what emphasis people put on what syllable when it comes to these old ideas. This crisis is a terrible thing to waste thing is a pernicious idea. It's undemocratic or anti-democratic because, look, there's a reason why when you're at war, you put down a lot of distractions, right? You know, war is one of those times where I never like the phrase, the time for debate is over, or the time for argument is over. But sometimes the time for argument is over, and war is one of them, right? And so is, like, if a meteor is barreling towards planet Earth, you know, you figure out what you need to do, but then you just start doing it because time is of the essence and you got to win and it's a fight for survival and yada, 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 yada. That is the idea inherent in this idea that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. It gives people permission to skip the normal rules about debate, about democracy, about civil rights, about all sorts of things. Look, I will be more sympathetic to trampling the civil rights and property rights of people if we have 60 days to stop a meteor from hitting Earth than I would be if no such meteor was coming. And this is why I really hate all the crisis talk with the climate change thing, because it is a way to short circuit debate and say, you know, when you say the time for argument is over, what you're really saying is shut up and do what I want. And that is fundamentally anti-democratic, undemocratic, unpluralistic. It is statist. And it has analogs in all sorts of ideological constructs, but it's a human thing, right? I mean, again, a lot of ideological constructs are emanations and penumbras of more core psychological tropes and sociological imperatives. And this crisis thing triggers all sorts of things in the human brain that give you permission to cut corners, to skip steps, and to disregard the concerns of others. And so it's illiberal. And what we're getting, people, this is a passionate both sides or argument, what we're getting from people who say we're one election from America being over, it's a moral equivalent of war argument. It's a crisis argument. It's a meteor is coming argument. And liberalism, democracy, cannot endure with a people where the citizenry is so hyped up, so roided out with this, you know, adrenal paranoia about how everything's about to come to an end. Because you need a people that are willing to be deliberative. You're willing to need a people, an electorate, an elite, because this problem is running straight through the elite. You need people, citizens, leaders, followers, voters, Americans, who are willing to realize there's going to be another election. That, you know, this is a point I've made to, you know, sort of the donor world when I, you know, used to speak to it a lot about, you know, the importance of good think tanks and, you know, and places like National Review and The Dispatch, right? Is, I mean, I don't talk to donors about The Dispatch, but you get the point that, you know, there are a lot of people want to have like this immediate impact on the next election because they want to be in the mix and they're following politics like it's, you know, the NFL, and they want to do their boosterism kind of thing for their team. And I get that. And, you know, that's part of American democracy. Fine. But if you actually have a more realistic time horizon about how you affect change, lasting change doesn't happen with one election. It happens with 3, 4, 5 elections. Charlie Cook makes this point all the time over at NR, is like part of the problem with what the Republicans are doing to the GOP is very similar to what the Democrats did screwing up the Democratic Party, you know, over the last 20 years. Is like, if you want an enduring Senate majority, you need to build that up over multiple elections. If you want to build up a consensus about a public policy, you need to do it over multiple elections. That's how you move the Overton window. And if you want to change hearts and minds and institutions, you need to stop thinking that your time horizon is built on a 24 or 48 month cycle based on, you know, what politicians demand from you. The politicians have a deep-seated interest in telling you like their election matters more than any other election. But what matters more in a democracy are ideas. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Well, it's a little here, it's a little there. But this catastrophization stuff just takes people out of the right mindset. It's a little like Commander in the White House, this point I was making last week. Dogs shouldn't be biting people, particularly not German shepherds. But if they are in a constant state of hormonal anxiety, where they're constantly feeling under threat, where they're smelling, you know, pheromones and weird stuff in the air that make them feel like they got to be on edge. Every time someone comes up to them, they're going to think, maybe I should bite this guy. That's what we're doing to voters when we talk about, you know, so-and-so is going to destroy America. It's part and parcel of a lot of other stuff that got into the G5 about how we are basically turning politics into a form of totalizing religion. And the presidency is basically the sort of papal avatar of this very Manichaean view of politics that says our team is good and their team is evil. And if their team gets into power, they will do evil at every turn. I think we've had a lot of bad presidents in American life. None of them have destroyed America. Some have had very lasting changes, but like they haven't destroyed America. Look out your window. The same people were telling me what an idiot I am for saying Biden won't destroy America. And a lot of people were telling me that. I guarantee you a big chunk of them were the same people who totally believed Donald Trump when he said Biden would destroy America in 2020. What I find fascinating, I got a lot of positive reaction, but I got a lot of negative, a lot of weird. Some of the reaction was so negative. I asked Declan if we changed the distribution list on the Wednesday G-File, which is only supposed to go to paid subscribers normally, because there were just a lot of people who were like, I don't know why I got this garbage. And I think that one of the reasons why some people got it is I think a lot of dispatch readers forwarded it to other readers and said, hey, you know, you might want to take a look at this. I mean, I know that happened a bunch because some people told me. And the thing I have a hard time grappling with is the inability of some people to grapple with my point. It's very similar. I know I bring it up all the time, you know, how people of a certain anti-Trump bent get mad at me when I say Trump isn't Hitler, right? And Trump's not going to be Hitler. They get mad at me because they think I'm defending Trump. When in reality, what I'm doing is I'm condemning Hitler. I'm like reserving for Hitler a certain immoral status that is greater than other people who are bad people, but not Hitler. I mean, like, again, if you say anybody who's bad is literally Hitler, then what you're doing is it's almost a kind of Holocaust denial, because what it's doing is it's reducing Hitler's crime, of which, you know, I think the Holocaust is number one on my list, but like I can see how, you know, Poles and countries that he invaded, you know, they might have a different order. It doesn't really matter. The point is Hitler was a bad dude. He did things that were metaphysically, morally, definitionally more evil than things that even other dictators did. Hitler was much worse than Mussolini. And yet, you know, it's so funny. It's like, you know, people just go to Hitler because Hitler occupies this place in people's brains. And if you say, and I think there's a much greater chance that Trump is like Mussolini than he is like Hitler. I don't think he's going to be Mussolini either. Mussolini was an intellectual, for starters. But Mussolini did not kill that many of his own people, which, again, people, when I say that to people, they think, you're defending Mussolini? I was like, no, I just think like killing a couple dozen people is different than liquidating millions of people. I'm willing to make these gradations. And I fully appreciate, you know, the Catholic and Muslim, to a certain extent, and other religious points of view that say to kill one person is the equivalent to killing the whole world. I don't actually believe that. At least I wouldn't want to base policy around that. But I get the point, you know. Regardless, it's like you can still be bad and not be Hitler. Similarly, you can still be a bad president and have bad consequences for this country without destroying this country. And it is just shocking to me how many people, you know, wrote to me and say, I don't understand how you know, this is so stupid. This reasoning is so idiotic. How can you say Joe Biden is not destroying America? Or how can you say he wouldn't destroy America? Or I got from quite a few people, how can you say Donald Trump wouldn't destroy America? This gets back to my point about the crisis mentality. I have enough faith in the American people, including Democrats, including Trump supporters, that when push comes to shove, the number of people who actually want to murder other people, want to put other people in camps or put or cancel elections or shut down newspapers or all that kind of stuff is going to be much smaller than the number of jackwads who say they're in favor of that on Twitter. I still fundamentally believe this is a good and decent country. And that applies to, a lot of Trump voters, a lot of Biden voters, even Cornel West voters and Robert F. Kennedy voters. And I got problems with all you people. Don't get me wrong. And I think none of those people would be a good president. I think Donald Trump would be a terrible president. I think there are much better arguments for not electing Donald Trump than there are for Joe Biden. I just do. I think as a matter of sort of civic hygiene, at the very least, anybody who interferes with the peaceful transfer of power should be disqualified from public life, regardless of these arguments about impeachment, not impeachment, you know, this trial, that trial. I'm disappointed in voters that they don't see it this way. They're just like, okay, we're done with this guy. He should be, pelted from the public stage. And I understand what that worries a lot of people. You know, this is sort of counter to my point, is that the fact that it doesn't worry the vast majority of Republicans enough to have them act on it is a cause of concern. But I just don't, when you actually talk to most of those people, again, not on Twitter, they've kind of convinced themselves Trump didn't do what he actually did, or the media's not portrayed it truthfully, and he wouldn't actually do the kind of stuff that he clearly did, and blah, 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 blah. It's not like they're like, damn right he did it and he should do it again. You know, this is one of these weird sort of ironies about a lot of Trump defenses, is that, and it's a weird irony about, a lot of the progressive stuff about democracy. They say, the Democratic Party is in favor of democracy and the Republican Party is not in favor of democracy, and that the Trump voters are anti-democracy and blah, 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 blah. Now, I get some of the arguments. I think there's some objective criticisms of Republicans who supported Donald Trump that are utterly valid. But if you actually stop for just 2 seconds and listen to what Donald Trump says, what Trump voters say, they're actually in favor of democracy too. I think they're confused in a bunch of facts, but you don't hear most of them saying, yeah, we got to get rid of democracy. You got a lot of goobers and jackwads and poltroons and jabronis saying really stupid stuff about, dictator this and whatever that, and even telling some pollsters all that kind of stuff. I don't actually believe it's as pervasive as people think it is. And the most common rhetoric you hear from both sides is that democracy is important and the other side hates democracy. And this is one of the really frustrating things about our politics, is it's sort of like the attacks on Nikki Haley during the debates from, Ramaswamy and DeSantis. They had, and J.D. Vance too, and all that crowd, is they have to lie about what somebody else's position is so they can attack them. If your position is Nikki Haley is wrong because she wants to send American troops into Ukraine, you're lying. If her policy is wrong, you should be able to describe it accurately. This is one of the great tests of fair-minded journalists, is how accurately you describe the opposing side of the argument's position. And I'm not saying I've been perfect about it in my 25-year career. I think that sometimes attacking the weakest link and plucking the lowest hanging fruit is fun. But, as Ramesh always likes to say, he wanted to tackle the progressives' best arguments, not their worst arguments. And when you read Ramesh, you'll find that he takes pains to describe his opponent's positions fairly and accurately. And so much of our debate is this, kabuki theater where you're describing demonic figures on the other side, or picking, or nut picking a handful of crazies and saying they're all like this, and arguing with essentially straw men. And this is how you get to this "they'll destroy America" garbage. And so anyway, I just like the inability of people to understand that I can be very critical of Joe Biden or very critical of Donald Trump, and I will continue to be so. This is going to be a safe place for both sides-ism dyspepsia for the next 8 months and probably a lot longer. And you can read more about that in our fourth ever editorial, which just went up this morning. But I can be critical of both teams and the voters for both teams without saying, if you think I'm wrong, you're in favor of destroying America. Because that's the other thing that drives me crazy, is that people get very, very angry when you don't share their premise. So it's like, you don't understand, we have to move all these people off this property so we can build this thing to stop the meteor from coming to planet Earth. And that is a great argument if we've both agreed that the meteor is fast on its way to planet Earth. But if I don't think there's a meteor coming to planet Earth, you cannot get pissed off at me for disagreeing with you about the need to extirpate people from their property. So I listened to the advisory opinions where David and Sarah went a little, got a little spicy towards each other. I don't think a normal person would think it was all that contentious, but if you actually know them well, it was more contentious than you might normally expect. And it was all about the Supreme Court decision on the Colorado ballot. I'm torn about it. I'm not exactly where David is, but I'm not where Sarah is either. I think the dissent made some very good points about the faulty, and so did David in his New York Times piece and elsewhere, about the faulty reasoning of the majority opinion. So during the AO debate, there was Sarah read from a passage from the decision, and it clanged off of my ear like, wait, what? And so I have a bone to pick. I probably should just wait till I can talk to Sarah or David about this and ask them about it. I'm not good at reading Supreme Court decisions. I'm not fluent with the cases that they cite and all that kind of stuff. But there's this passage. I'm trying to figure out where to start reading from. Although the 14th Amendment restricts state power, nothing in it plainly withdraws from the states this traditional authority. And after ratification of the 14th Amendment, states use this authority to disqualify state officers in accordance with state statutes. See Worthy v. Barrett and blah, 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 blah. Such power over governance, however, does not extend to federal office holders and candidates, because federal officers, quote, owe their existence and function to the unified voice of the whole, not of a portion of the people, unquote. Powers over their election and qualifications must be specifically, quote, delegated to rather than reserved by the states, unquote. And apparently this was in U.S. Term Limits, Inc. v. Thornton, and also quoting from Justice Story's commentaries on the Constitution, blah, 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 blah. Then it says, but nothing in the Constitution delegates to the states any power to enforce Section 3 against federal office holders and candidates. Okay, I'm not qualified to argue with a lot of that. I am sure there's an explanation to my objection. I have a half theory on this, or thought. Whole thought, half theory, maybe wrong. This phrasing of owe their existence and function to the unified voice of the whole, not of a portion of the people, as befits federal office is officers, I just think is wrong. Like, and again, someone will explain to me why I'm not. I just, until proven otherwise, which I'm totally open to, I'm just completely missing something important here. But first of all, there are only two officers of the United States that everybody in the country, in effect, gets to vote on. That's the president and vice president. So, like, this statement is just flatly not true about senators, right? Only people from California get to vote on only people from California get to vote on for California senators. Only people from Rhode Island get to vote for representatives from Rhode Island. And so they're not speaking for the unified voice of the whole. Second, like, certainly the presidency as originally conceived of wasn't about the unified voice of all the people, right? I mean, first of all, the Electoral College used to have a little more heft to it. And it still has heft in terms of it being dispositive for the election. And so, like, the states as units vote for president, not the people, right? I mean, we can get, I know, incorporation of the Civil War amendments and universal suffrage changes a lot of these things, but it is certainly not antithetical to our concept, to the founders' conception of the Constitution, to say that this sentence is wrong. But that's not my primary objection. The reason why it clanged off my ear, and I wouldn't go confirm it, we're talking about the Colorado Republican primary, not the general election. And I assume, like, the what I'm missing here is that because party elections have been, primary elections have been sort of folded into state election law in ways that they weren't in this, you know, the 18th and 19th and early 20th century, that primary elections are also, for all purposes under the law, as much an election as a general election. But again, getting to this idea about this unitary voice of the people thing, for most of American history, basically until 1972 to one extent or another, lots of people who became president weren't on the ballot in lots of states. You had favorite son candidates. You had sort of power brokers who were being, you know, party bosses, governors, whatever, who were sent to the convention knowing that they were never going to be a viable candidate for president or even viable candidate for the nomination, but they were given delegates to horse trade with. If you go back and you look at who won the primaries in the 1968 Democratic primaries, most of the top finishers are people you never heard of because they were, you know, like LBJ backed candidates or Eugene McCarthy backed candidates or just other weirdos, right? Because the conventions made these decisions, not voters in primaries until the 70s. So this idea that somehow taking a candidate off the ballot in Colorado is somehow inimical or antithetical or otherwise contrary to the voice of the unified whole of the people, I just don't think makes a lot of historical sense in the sort of in the history and tradition part of text history and tradition. Now, I'm sure I am missing something, but like this claim that you have different states with different standards about who to keep on the ballot and who to keep off the ballot. So what? I mean, I get it. It makes things uglier and more complicated and all that kind of stuff. But I am increasingly of the mind that, like, we need more complexity, more hoops to jump through in our politics. You know, it needs to be more of a Rube Goldberg machine, not less. The streamlining of our politics is one of the problems of our politics these days. I want more coalitions. I want more factions. I want more backstops and rules that people have to conform to. I don't want to make everything easier. I think making it easier to vote was a problem. And I think streamlining all this stuff so that, you know, the end result now is basically that we are voting as if we live in a parliamentary system. I think the number of states left that have split a Republican and Democratic senator is maybe all gone, or was there one or two left? The number of times that states vote differently for president than they do for Senate in terms of the parties is gone. I don't think that's good. I think you want more cross-pollination, right? You want voters to be able to simultaneously hold in their mind the possibility that they want a president from one party and a Senate from another party. Split ticket voting, we derided it for years and years and years, but it actually has a lot of benefits to it. And so this idea that, like, oh my gosh, the rules that kept so-and-so off the ballot in Rhode Island didn't keep so-and-so off the ballot in Maryland. Okay. So, like, maybe the solution to that is to move more towards a convention system with the parties where the person who got elected on the ballot in Rhode Island has delegates that he can now trade with whoever to get the guy who was kept off the ballot elected. I mean, that's fine. I want more transactional stuff. I want more opportunities for parties and politicians to do politics. There's this cult of efficiency that runs through a lot of American life that is on both sides. We don't recognize it because we all subscribe to it. I'm moving a little far afield, but this is a very old argument when it comes to things like commerce, right? Railroads hated the idea of having a patchwork of different rules and regulations as you built a railroad across an entire continent, right? You needed some sort of predictability and uniformity of the rules to allow you to cross through different jurisdictions. Imagine if every county had different rules about how wide the track would be. Trains would go nowhere, right? Similarly, like today, car industry gets very mad at California because California sets standards just for California, but because California is such a big market, it basically imposes California's regulations on the entire country instead of federal regulations. I have more sympathy for some of these arguments about economics than some of my ruthless efficiency friends do, but not a lot because I think, economics is a little different. But for politics, I know I'm a broken record on this, I got no problem with different rules in different jurisdictions. It's no coincidence, I should say, that a lot of the arguments about railroad efficiency coincided with a lot of the amendments to the Constitution after the Civil War about other forms of efficiency. And I understand those because we're trying to get rid of slavery and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, getting rid of slavery was a good thing. But the incorporation of all those amendments basically means that, like, there's very little leeway for one state to have a higher voting age than another state or any of that kind of stuff, or to do politics differently. And I think that's a mistake. The genius of the sort of Madisonian vision of America is to sort of layer this country horizontally and vertically with all sorts of different levels of government that had elections constantly that allowed different factions and different communities to organically form based around, you know, different rules. The nationalization of our culture through social media, through cable TV, interferes with that. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I think it's a bad thing. You know, when Tip O'Neill said all politics is local, he was right. It's not right anymore. All politics is becoming nationalized. And I think this feeds into this religious-like view of politics I was talking about before, because when you nationalize a vast continental nation of over 330 million people into the politics of a small town, people get very angry about people living the wrong way thousands of miles away from them. And they think that the government in Washington should be doing something about it. And I think that this sort of mindset, this sort of one size fits all politics, is one of the things that fuels the catastrophization. You know, I mean, I've used this analogy a million times, but like we view presidents now the way Catholics and Protestants in 1600s England viewed the throne. Just the idea of having a monarch of another faith on the throne felt like the entire warp and woof of the cosmos was being disrupted. Like, that's not who we are and all that kind of stuff. And that's now how people feel about the presidency. But the fact remains is, like, having a Democrat in the White House doesn't destroy America, you know, any more than having a Protestant on the throne would destroyed England. And I should be clear, the analogy kind of breaks down when you're talking about pre-democratic regimes, but you get the point. It's like the feeling of disruption and disquietude and heresy that comes when our nationalized politics is going the wrong way creates a kind of existential panic in people that gives permission to use this language about destroying America. America's not being destroyed. A lot of bad decisions are being made. Don't get me wrong. A lot of the people who say that America's being destroyed are part of the thing that they're making a lot of the bad decisions. And that's true on the left and on the right. I would so much rather have the pyramid of governance in this country inverted, right? I would be so tolerant of local levels of illiberalism as long as the federal government was libertarian, right? I'm a libertarian at the federal level with the exception of like robust military stuff and a few other things, like, you know, the stuff in the Constitution plus, you know, the borders and a few other things, right? They're like eight things I think the federal government should be doing for the most part. And then state governments should have a lot more power, and then local governments even more power. And then the most power should be in your family. And with all the backstops about, you know, you can't have slavery, you can't abuse people, you can't treat people like instruments or property, everybody has innate dignity, yada, yada, yada. But like, if the post-liberal Catholic integralists come up with a sort of an ultra-montane Amish lifestyle or something, or if they want people to be serfs, as long as they have the right to quit being serfs when they want to, which kind of negates the point of being a serf, go ahead, but just do it in rural Vermont somewhere. Like, don't try to impose your BS on the entire country. And the same goes for progressives. Don't try to impose your BS on the entire country. Deal with people where they actually live, where there's a certain amount of pluralism and voluntarism and a sense of communal interest that makes you a faction against other factions in the bigger system. This popular front thing where we're reducing all sides, both sides, into one homogenous blob is what's wrecking our politics and is what it's making this catastrophizing rhetoric seem so plausible to so many people. And so anyway, all I want to say to the people who wrote me screaming at me, some of you made perfectly fine points. They don't really rebut anything I wrote because I stipulated many times neither of these guys are doing great. They seem to, again, it's like saying Trump isn't Hitler. They think if I say Biden isn't destroying America, that means I think he's doing a great job. And I cannot be answerable to your inability to grasp some very basic distinctions. But just, you know, I'm not going to give in to all the catastrophizing, and I make no apologies for the points that I made. And anyway, done with all that. What else to talk about? We have a new technology newsletter. I got to find out how I'm supposed to pronounce it. I think it's Techni, but it might be Techna. And it's by my AI colleague, Will Reinhart. And we're very excited to have him on board. You should subscribe. He knows a lot about this stuff. And again, we got a new editorial on how American people should demand better than this garbage from our political system. Oh, so yeah, I'm sorry. I kept the punditry out of this. I didn't watch the State of the Union. I watched a bunch of the clips, and I didn't watch Katie Britt's response. I just watched a bunch of clips. Meh. Exhausting. I think Biden's thinking, I didn't like the State of the Union. I don't like the State of the Union. I want to go back to a written document. I'm a little torn about the punditry on this insofar as I still firmly believe that the election is going to be won in the middle, not by rallying the base. And the middle right now is defined as double haters, which I don't think that term is going to go away anytime soon. It's people who don't like both Biden and Trump. And as of right now, they split better for Biden than for Trump, but there are polls suggesting that that's shaky. And so I would prefer a State of the Union address that actually reached out to the saner parts of our politics. But I think just as a matter of strategery, the Biden crowd knows that they are hemorrhaging support among their base because both parties are obsessed with their bases. They think this is a bigger problem than it is, but it is a real problem. And so I think the strategy going into this was to help secure the base, reassure the doubters, and then move on. But, you know, attacking the Supreme Court in the room, it's just a terrible look. You know, I'm a norms guy. You can't be only for upholding norms for one team, and that's gross. The Katie Britt thing was weird. I think it played weirder in real time than it does when you're trying to catch up on it the next day, because basically everybody was freaked out by it, from what I can tell. when it was actually unfolding. But you watch it the next day, you're like, okay, this is certainly overwrought and overdone, but it didn't hit me in the clips the way it clearly hit a lot of people when watching it in real time. And I'm kind of glad she blew it, because I actually kind of like her. And I think she would be a very smart VP candidate for Trump. And I don't want her to be his VP candidate, because I think she would be a good candidate for him. That said, you know, I've had this theory. I think I floated it on here before a few times. I think that the people around Trump do not want a reliable, reassuring vice presidential pick. I don't think Trump wants one either, but for sort of different psychological reasons. I think the advisors don't want it because they actually know that Trump is going to be on a pretty short leash for impeachment, particularly if he starts to follow through on some of the dictator stuff day one, or goes for retribution day three, that kind of thing. And it makes it so much easier to impeach and remove Donald Trump if the person who would replace him is a solid, not crazy Republican. I suspect what they really want is the craziest, least acceptable vice president who doesn't hurt his chances of getting elected. You know, you want like a Carrie Lake type who the Trumpers can hold up as like a Medusa's head and say, sure, you can get rid of me, but do you want this as your president? But maybe I'm wrong. This is the rankest of punditry. I saw a bunch of people, Ari Fleischer, I think, some other people were criticizing Biden for opening with the Ukraine. We're talking about Ukraine. Again, I didn't see it, so if I'm getting this wrong, I apologize. And the idea being Ari Fleischer, who I've lost so much respect for, can't begin to tell you, that he shouldn't have started with something that was divisive. I think that was the phrasing of it. The thing is, this is one of the things that drives me crazy, is like, support for Ukraine is not divisive. It's divisive in the House Republican caucus because, you know, a bunch of Trump fanboys think that like opposing Ukraine aid is what Trump wants. And it probably is what Trump wants. But if the Ukraine aid or the Israel aid were, if Johnson would just put it on the floor, it would pass. American people are very sympathetic to Ukraine. It's this very online J.D. Vance crowd that has convinced itself it's speaking for the real people and is the authentic voice of real America, and that real Americans don't care if Ukraine is erased. And like we got more information in the last week about how Vladimir Putin wants to fundamentally erase Ukraine. And, you know, I wrote about it for the LA Times this week. It was a editorial process for understandable reasons to a certain extent. I mean, I knew I was biting onto something about this whole Israel's committing genocide thing, which I've talked about here. Israel's not committing genocide. Israel may be doing lots of arguments that Israel's doing bad things, that it has a inhumane disregard for Palestinian lives, that it's warmongering, you know, whatever. You can come up with all sorts of adjectives, but they don't amount to genocide. Just like, again, you can say all sorts of bad things about Donald Trump and criticize him in all sorts of ways that are true. They don't amount to Adolf Hitler. And like, you know, there are two ways to define genocide. One is the sort of dictionary meaning, which basically means like a Holocaust style erasure of a people or a country. That is the etymological root of the word genocide. This guy, Raphael Lemkin, I think that's his name, coined the term after the Holocaust, because Winston Churchill had said, we're witnessing a crime that we don't have a word for. And so they came up with genocide. And there's a really fascinating history in the UN about how to define for international law purposes what genocide means, which is a little different than the dictionary meaning, a little more expansive. And I mean, I've written about this before. One of the most annoying things is that the Soviets, who had outsized influence in the UN, insisted that destroying people, you could like, so like the definition of genocide can be destroying an ethnicity, a religious group, a national group, blah, blah, blah. But destroying an economic class is not included. And it's not included because that's the kind of genocide the Soviets really dug. Whether it was the kulaks or whoever, you know, the way they let themselves off the hook for a lot of their mass murder was to say it doesn't fit the UN definition of genocide. And that's because they overly influenced how the UN defined genocide. But that's neither here nor there. The Russians far more fit the definition of genocide than Israel does. You know, they are saying that they want to erase the cultural, geographic, and legal construct that is Ukraine. They are not discriminating between lawful combatants and civilians by policy. Right, this distinction between Hamas and the Ukrainians needs to be sort of better understood by people. Hamas deliberately hides in ways to maximize civilian casualties. Right, they use human beings, their own people, as shields. The fighters get bomb shelters, the citizens get stuck on the street. And there's nothing, you can go read David's great stuff on this. There's nothing in the law of war that says Israel has to completely respect an enemy that is using, like, if you use a hospital as a weapons depot or as a HQ for fighters, Israel's under no obligation under international law to abstain from attacking the hospital. The fault for inviting an attack on a hospital lies with Hamas for using a hospital illegally according to international law. Now, this doesn't mean as a practical matter, as a moral matter, that Israel should just carpet bomb a hospital. I don't think it should. The Israelis don't think they should. Israel's critics think that that's what Israel wants to do and accuse it of doing that kind of thing all the time, inaccurately. And so, meanwhile, what the Russians have been doing is just simply attacking civilian population centers wherever convenient, attacking hospitals, attacking daycare centers, sometimes discriminatingly in the sense of trying to find them and bomb them, and other times just not caring because they're sending dumb things up in the air to land wherever they land. All with the intended and stated purpose of erasing Ukraine as a country. That is much closer to genocide than anything that Israel is doing. It's not a defense of everything Israel does, but the inability or unwillingness of people to be, the people who say they're so offended by genocide really only seem to be offended by Israel, even when Israel isn't guilty of genocide. But when China is guilty of genocidal, certainly cultural genocide against Uyghurs and against Tibet, people shrug. And it's enough to make you think that maybe it has something to do with just that Israel's Jewish. I think it has something to do with that. I think it has to do with some other things too, including some faulty history about how Israel was founded. But I think, like, stopping Russia from doing that is a moral imperative. I wrote about this last week, you know, had a friendly disagreement with Michael and Brendan Doherty about this stuff. I think the moral arguments for helping Ukraine are just cut and dried. I've not seen anything compelling. I'm not saying there are no good points. I just don't think the points amount to much on the anti-side. I've seen nothing compelling to change the moral calculus here. What Putin is doing is evil. The Russians are behaving, are the indisputable villains in all of this. Doesn't mean everything Ukraine does is great, but again, we can make these distinctions. But I think at this point, a lot of the arguments about the morality of it are kind of incidental. We gave our word. We said that that Ukraine could count on us for as long as it takes. That matters. I mean, it matters for Ukraine, obviously, but it matters for us. Like, we are heading into a multipolar world with lots of sort of great power type, rivalry type things. Even if you could persuade me that we shouldn't give a rat's ass about the morality of helping Ukraine, or that it was even like not in our interest to help Ukraine in some way, the fact that we gave our word and that people are paying attention and trying to figure out whether we are a reliable ally or not matters enormously. And the disregard of that, I find to be, I don't know, it depends who we're talking about. For some people, I think it's a really profound tell, right? It just basically is, it reveals that they actually don't care about what the world is going to look like and think that we can retreat from it. Or there, other people look forward to that, which I think is weird, but okay. And then there are other people who, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I think are just dumb and have convinced themselves of this stupid morality tale that says Putin's good because he likes Trump and all that kind of stuff. But this is not the kind of thing that we can afford to do going into the world ahead of us. You know, the people who say, oh, nuclear proliferation is so bad. If I'm Japan and I'm looking at how unreliable America seems to be as an ally, I want nuclear weapons. If I'm Saudi Arabia, I want nuclear weapons. And, you know, people who think that non-nuclear arms proliferation is bad, the more unreliable America seems, the more every country that can is going to spend on defense buildup, either nuclear or non-nuclear, because they think they're going to be on their own. And, you know, maybe we've made too many commitments and overpromised. That's an argument for not making more promises. It is not an argument for keeping the promises you already made. And it just is a no-brainer to me that it is hugely important to help Ukraine. And I think I started this because I was talking about Ari Fleischer. The idea that this is divisive is just not true, right? It's only divisive because Mike Johnson, in subservience to sort of the House Freedom Caucus and the idiotic, you know, only takes one vote to vacate the chair thing, is terrified of bringing it up. But it would pass. It would pass with lots of Democratic votes and lots of Republican votes. It would certainly pass if it was a secret vote, which would not bother me very much in the slightest. Anyway. All right, I'm done. I'm tired. And I'll be home Sunday. Not that you really care. And, David French, Adam, and I did part two of our nerd freakout about Dune, the sequel. And I got to say, I'm still thinking, trying to calibrate exactly where I come down on Dune. But I mean, I really liked the movie and we talked about it a bunch. Of course, I was never going to like it as much as David does. But you should only listen to it, A, if you're interested, which I completely understand if you're not. And B, if you've seen Dune 2. Or C, if you don't care about hearing about spoilers and you haven't seen the second part, because we make no effort to hide spoilers because there's no point in doing that. We did a podcast for the Skiff before it came out and then the follow up after. And like, it's only for Dune nerds, really. I mean, some people liked it more than I thought they would. And even though they're not Dune nerds, truth in advertising, it's aimed at Dune nerds and sci-fi nerds. And, but it was fun to do. And I think we're probably going to do more, Nerdorama stuff in the future. So with that, thanks for listening and I'll talk to you next time.